Hi, everyone. Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. You know by now that the mission in my work is to empower people to make informed food choices, to debunk myths about veganism, to be a voice for animals, and to give people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and kindness. As we enter the 13th year of Food for Thought podcast, which is an award-winning podcast, thanks to you, it won Veg News Magazine's awards again this year for best podcast. I thought it merited a rebroadcasting of some favorite episodes and some episodes that just merit re-listening. So you can always subscribe to Food for Thought. Please do so at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also subscribe to Animology, the spinoff podcast of Food for Thought. And of course, you can follow me on social media. And because of you, this podcast is going on 13 years later. So I appreciate your support, the support of everyone who's a Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau and help it go on for yet another year. And just keep in mind that inevitably, after all these years, some websites I may mention on the podcast episodes may be defunct. Certainly, I am not Compassionate Cooks anymore. You can just find my work at ColleenPatrickGoudreau.com or JoyfulVegan.com. Just keep in mind that while some websites may be dated, the information itself is not. And so I give you this podcast episode of the award-winning Food for Thought podcast. Enjoy. Today's topic is, if I let you eat oysters, will you stop eating cows? As you've probably heard me say in the past, I have heard every justification for the consumption of animals and every excuse that keeps people from leaving animals off their plate. But the first time I had heard that eating oysters and other bivalves should be considered vegan was when I read the 2010 Slate article called Consider the Oyster, Why Even Strict Vegans Should Feel Comfortable Eating Oysters by the Boatload. So I thought, okay, I'll bite the article. I'm not going to bite the oysters, but I'll read this article. And part of me, a really big part of me, didn't want to. I didn't feel it was worth my time to even read this thing. But because I knew I would probably hear it referenced and used as a justification for consuming oysters, and I knew I'd be asked about it, I figured I'd give it a read. The author of this article, Consider the Oyster, opens by saying he was visiting a friend in the San Francisco Bay Area, which of course is my area, who recalled that he was vegan and thus didn't eat meat, dairy, and eggs, but who loved tucking into oysters. And so his wonderful host promised a feast of oysters for him when he visited from Point Reyes. Now, remember that name, Point Reyes? We will return to Point Reyes oysters before I am through. In the article, the author concedes that he shouldn't call himself vegan, but rather pescatarian, because he concedes that oysters are animals. But he says that vegans and vegetarians should feel comfortable eating oysters, I'm quoting him, by the boatload. Weeding through his ethical gymnastics, what I was able to glean from this article and his justification is that his main justification for advocating for oyster consumption is that though they're animals, they don't have a central nervous system and are thus closer to plants than animals who can feel pain and suffer. However, what I was also able to glean was that he just really likes eating oysters, and so he found a way to justify doing so and still have a clear conscience about it, conveniently recategorizing oysters as plants in his brain. He found a way to defend his consumption of them. Well, that worked out well for him. That's always convenient if we can kind of recategorize things for our own gain. But if you're asking me what I think, and many of you have asked what I think, here is my take about oysters, but I'm going to speak more broadly about bivalves. There are gray areas in this whole intention for living compassionately, consistently compassionately. That's really my aim. Consistently compassionately, like not perfectly compassionately, but living consistently compassionately. And although lines can be fuzzy and gray, they're still lines. And I don't think it's arbitrary for me to say that I don't eat oysters or clams or mussels or any bivalve because they're animals. Now, if the scientific community changed that line and actually recategorized them as plants, would it be a different story? I guess it would if they were 100% definite, if they were 100% certain that bivalves were plants in the sense that they don't feel any pain at all. But since, even as ethicist Peter Singer says, quote, one cannot with any confidence say that these creatures do feel pain, so one can equally have little confidence in saying that they do not feel pain, end quote. And no, the same cannot be said of plants. Plants don't have neurons. Animals, including bivalves, do. Bivalves have a nerve cord and nerve ganglia, which means they have clusters of nerves, including a cerebral ganglion. Plants don't. Plants photosynthesize. Animals don't. They eat and they poop. There is a difference. There is a line. And it's not arbitrary to recognize that line. We know with certainty that plants don't feel pain. We don't know with certainty that bivalves don't feel pain. And hence my philosophy of living. Unless and until we know more about those gray areas, I'm comfortable applying the precautionary principle to my decisions, to my choices. Technically speaking, the precautionary principle basically states that if an action has a suspected risk of causing harm, in the absence of scientific consensus that the action is not harmful, the burden of proof that it's not harmful falls on those taking that action, which in this case is eating bivalves. The precautionary principle is what leads me to say that I don't care enough about eating scallops or oysters or mussels or clams that I'm going to take the chance that I'm going to create some harm that I could prevent by not eating scallops or oysters or mussels. The potential risk outweighs the potential benefit. And just to return to that article, Consider the Oyster, which of course is a play on the title of David Forrest Wallace's widely popular and thoughtful article in Gourmet magazine many years ago called Consider the Lobster. The author in Consider the Oyster asks the questions he feels he already has an answer to. He asks, what if we could find an animal that thrived in a factory farm cage, one that subsisted on nutrients plucked from the air and that was insensate to the slaughterhouse blade? And for him, that animal is the oyster. And I guess that's one of my problems with his argument, this desire to find the least harmful way to consume animals when we already have an alternative. We already have a better option. We already have an entire category of food that doesn't need to be factory raised, that doesn't need to be factory farmed, that doesn't feel pain, that is insensate, that doesn't suffer. That's the category of plants. But it's almost like some people refuse to let go of the fact that we just don't need to consume animals in order to be satisfied or healthy or happy. I mean, clearly the writer of this article knows this. By his admission, he doesn't eat any other animals but oysters. Though I have to say, just as an aside, the tone of his article is very snarky, and I'm not even sure I believe that he wasn't just framing the story that way, that he was an oyster-eating vegan just because it's more provocative. So I'm not sure I even am convinced or persuaded that he really is vegetarian in every other way, but he admits, he says by his admission, his own self-definition is that he's, you know, vegetarian, or in this case, he says, you know, at least I'm pescatarian. So he doesn't consume land animals. But then why is it that we have to still find a way to consume like someone in this category, right? Like, let it go. Like, are you really so attached to eating something from the animal kingdom that you have to find a way to justify it by ironically considering it a plant? Like, can't you just let go of even single-celled organisms? Like, that's what you have to hang on to? Can we not just say, okay, animal, as far as we know, by all the criteria we use to classify the organisms of the world, animal, and thus not mine to breed and keep and kill. That's my line. Animal, I'll eat plants. So animal over here, plants over here. Like, defending the right to eat oysters and still call yourself vegan, like, is that really the badge you want to wear? Is that really the fight you want to take on? is the question I would have. And another question I have for people like the author of this article is, if I gave you oysters to eat, will you stop eating cows and pigs and lambs and chickens? Like, I say that because, putting this author aside who claims he doesn't eat other animals, like, when non-vegans pose the question to vegans, whether we as vegans shouldn't concede that it's okay to eat bivalves because they don't have a central nervous system, I wish they were asking in earnest, in order to examine not my behavior and my ethics, but their own. I wish they weren't trying to catch me at being what they perceive as arbitrary or rigid. I wish rather that they recognize that for themselves, that if eating oysters is really the equivalent of eating plants, but eating all other animals is indeed harmful because it causes pain and suffering and environmental degradation, that they'd stop eating all other animals and stuck with oysters. Do you know what I mean? When people pose this question about vegans conceding that it's okay to eat oysters, like, come on, vegans, like, really? Come on, like, really, oysters? Like, you know, isn't that a little rigid? Like, I mean, the suggestion is that vegans need to be less rigid. Well, is that really the problem? That vegans are critical thinkers and try to live ethically and compassionately and so draw a line that just makes sense? I mean, I would suggest that the problem isn't that vegans need to be less rigid, but perhaps that non-vegans need to be more discerning. And so I would say to all of the non-vegans out there, if I let you eat oysters, would you stop eating pigs and cows and chickens? I mean, if we're talking about less harm, sure, I'll concede that breeding, raising, and killing oysters is less harmful than breeding, raising, and killing birds and mammals, but you can't have it all. You can't say that vegans should be less rigid. We're already doing something. You have to make some changes. You have to be more discerning. You have to make a choice. So if I gave you oysters, will you give me back the cows? If that's what you need to claim, then have them, take them, but leave the rest of the animals alone. If wanting to eat bivalves was the only thing that stopped you from being vegan, then have at them. Don't do nothing because you can't do everything. Do something, anything. But I don't think that's what it's really about for people. I think they don't want to feel that there's something they're not entitled to. Don't do nothing because you can't do everything. Do something, anything. We already have thousands of edible plants from which to choose. Can we not leave the animals alone? Like, there's a movement to start raising insects for human consumption because, as the argument goes, their carbon footprint is small relative to the amount of protein they provide, and they don't, so the argument goes, experience pain like we do. Well, okay, insects have a smaller footprint compared to what? Compared to the carbon footprint of the billions of mammals and birds being kept and killed for human consumption? Yeah, it's true. Insects also require less inputs for water, food, and space, and emit less pollution in return compared to mammals and birds. But that's just the barometer we use, which is a low barometer, the low bar, because we're breeding, keeping, and killing so many mammals and birds for human consumption. That's a pretty low bar. What happens when you compare the carbon footprint of growing plant foods versus insects? What then? Plant foods still come out better when you consider there's no need to process plant nutrients through animals, i.e. even the insects, and there's no need to raise plant foods to feed the insects, right? You don't need to raise plants to feed the plants. Like, I mean, like, we still have to do that with insects. As with most livestock production, commercial cricket production relies on grain products as a food source. A recent published study, and I'm going to keep this on the show notes for today's episode at joyfulvegan.com, they looked at this claim that insects are a better, lower carbon footprint alternative and concluded thus, quote, although it has been suggested that crickets reared for human or livestock consumption, because they're also talking about using insects for feed for livestock, although it's been suggested that crickets reared for human or livestock consumption may result in a more sustainable supply of protein, this study finds that such conclusions will depend in large part on what the crickets are fed and which systems of livestock production they're compared to. When fed grain-based diets at a scale of economic relevance, populations of crickets in this study showed little improvement compared to broiler chickens fed similar diets, no better than broiler chickens fed similar diets. We're so desperate to find a way to eat in such a way that has a lower carbon footprint, and yet we just can't let go of animals. Like, we can stop looking toward the animals, the insects, the crickets, the scallops, the mussels. We're so desperate to find a way to have our animal meat and eat it too that we think insect production is the answer. Not only am I going to bet that it's not going to be the magic bullet some are purporting it to be, there's also the ick factor. There's the gross factor, the disgust factor that the majority of folks are not going to be able to get over. And yet, the answer to our problems, our ethical problems, our health problems, our environmental problems, is staring us right in the face. They're called plants. Our choices are not limited to land animals or insects, aquatic animals or land animals. Like, those are not what we're limited to, but yet we pose it that way as if we're stuck with those two choices, right? It's still got to be in animals, but like, which is better? Like, we have this whole other category of better. So we know this is not a personal issue. We know this is not just about people, you know, making the choice that they're making because it's just personal. It's a political issue. We know that governments around the world have long failed their people, failed to promote the production or availability of a wide range of legumes and vegetables and fruits and nuts and seeds and beans, right? All of the things that encompass that plant kingdom. The very things that promote health, that don't destroy the environment, and yes, of course, I'm assuming that these things are grown in a sustainable way, and that don't intentionally bring sentient beings into this world only to kill them. And here's the best thing about plants from an ethical perspective. As I said, what we know to be true right now, make no mistake about it, is that they're plants. They don't have a central nervous system. They don't have any neurons at all. And for me, that's an easy line to draw. It's not a rigid line. It's just a line. If I'm wrong, if we find out definitively that scallops and oysters and mussels and clams don't feel pain and are actually plants, then, oh well, I guess what's the worst that happened? I went a few decades not eating these animals when I actually could have. That's not a big deal to me because, you know, here's a secret. It's just not that hard to not eat bivalves. Like, it's just not that hard. And bivalves don't really show up as byproducts either. So it's just not that hard to live a life not eating bivalves. Frankly, what I find hard is consuming enough nutrient-dense foods in like a single day, like plant foods. Like, there are only so many calories I can eat in a single day. And it's hard enough finding enough like caloric room for all those nutrient-dense plant foods, right? So it's not hard to not eat bivalves or bipearls, frankly, being a product of oysters. And then, of course, there are the health issues. I am happy not to consume the concentration of heavy metals and bacteria and toxins that comes with the consumption of aquatic animals, including the bivalves. And any claims about health benefits from bivalves, I'm happy to get my vitamins and minerals, such as iron and zinc, etc., through plant foods. Skip the middle oyster. Skip the heavy metals. It's a win, win, win. I want to take a moment to thank everyone who makes this podcast possible. Thank you to all of the regular ongoing platinum supporters. You can become a platinum supporter. You can become a gold supporter. You can become a silver supporter. You become a supporter. Thank you to everyone at every level. Every penny of the contribution you make goes to the work I do to help change the way we think about and treat animals and to empower people to live as compassionately and healthfully as possible. Thank you for helping me to do this work that changes hearts and minds. Please become a patron today. You can go to ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com under support, and you can just also go straight to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau. Thank you, each and every one of you listening out there. So you've got bivalve aquaculture, a multi-million dollar enterprise, and you've got the collection of wild bivalves around the world whose annual harvest is measured in metric tons. Proponents of bivalve aquaculture will often talk about the minimal environmental impacts of oysters, but will admit there are problems harvesting wild bivalves like clams and mussels because they're often dredged from the seabed and they disrupt the entire ecosystem there. Proponents of bivalve aquaculture talk about the fact that bivalves being filter feeders actually keep the water clean. and this goes back to what I said about the concentration of heavy metals and bacteria and viruses and toxins in the flesh of these critters. They are literally filtering those things into themselves, and then they're filtering the water and keeping it clean. But all of those things get absorbed by them, of course. And though it's true, because they are filter feeders, they do keep the water clean, that doesn't mean that that benefit comes from the industry, like, or that it has to come from like the aquaculture, you know, bivalve industry. Without touching these animals in the wild, like without actually making them a commodity and an industry, that's pretty much one of the parts they play, just because they are who they are in their ecosystem. But the reality of the world we live in is that value is often measured not intrinsically, but economically. And of course, when we value animals not for who they are, but what we gain by them, we make very different decisions about their welfare and about the welfare of the individuals and ecosystems affected by them. Basically, bivalve cultivation, so when we're talking about the environmental effects, bivalve cultivation can be broadly split into three main processes. There's seed collection, seed nursery, and on-growing is what it's called, and three, harvesting. So I'm going to read a little excerpt from a paper called Environmental Impacts of Bivalve Mariculture. Here's just a little excerpt. The environmental impacts of each cultivation stage, so I named the three stages for you, varies depending on the species in question and the techniques used. In many instances, commercial species are reared as seed in hatcheries prior to seeding, with few effects on the environment. However, while some species are collected from the wild using benign techniques, such as spat collectors, and spat, by the way, is the name for young oysters, others are extracted using intrusive devices, such as dredges. A growing number of studies of the ecological effects of mechanical collecting devices have demonstrated direct mortality of non-target species and the destruction of suitable settlement substrata, or habitats. In addition, other species such as birds, crabs, and starfish may be deprived of valuable food sources and habitat as a result of the mechanical harvesting of bivalve seed. The nursery and on-growing of bivalves includes either suspended culture subtidally, under the water, trestle culture intertidally, or cultivation directly on in the ground. Many of the environmental changes that occur result from their filter feeding activities that produce feces and pseudo-feces. This can lead to depletion of phytoplankton in densely cultivated systems and accumulation of silt and pseudo-feces beneath suspended cultures that often then results in a locally anoxic environment and faunal impoverishment. Anoxic refers to lack of oxygen. In addition, the structures used during the cultivation process can cause environmental change. For example, the use of netting to protect clams from crab predators leads to siltation and accumulations of sediment. Parks of trestles can drastically alter the water flow regime, leading to changes in sedimentation rate and oxygen exchange within the system. Extensive intertidal cultivation plots could deprive birds of feeding habitats, and the associated husbandry practices may disturb roosting birds. The final stage of cultivation involves harvesting. In many cases, this involves little more than emptying the bivalves from pouches or lifting ropes. However, in the case of species cultivated within sediment or relayed on the seabed, the use of intrusive techniques is required. Both dredgers and suction devices cause disruption of the sediment and kill or directly remove non-target species. So this is not a harmless endeavor. I am going to include the article there, that study, that paper, again, on the website for today's show notes. There's also wild ranching of such bivalves as scallops is also one of the aquaculture methods. And of course, because predators such as crabs and starfish, this was alluded to in the excerpt I just read, because they want to eat their natural prey, these bivalves, in order to stop them from doing so, areas must be cleared and then fenced to some degree. And harvesting is usually done by dredging in this case, especially with scallops, which further disrupts the seabed. So in other words, there's an effect. And interestingly, the environmental impacts of oyster farming, especially when you compare any kind of industry, any kind of aquaculture or agriculture, of course, when you compare it to the wild, of course, you are disrupting these natural processes and these natural ecosystems. And the environmental impacts of oyster farming was an issue in my own backyard for a couple of years. It was a big story. And you've probably heard about it if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the story I'm about to tell you is significant in terms of bivalve cultivation, but also in terms of this larger issue of the competition between industry, between agriculture, aquaculture, right, industry, and, you know, husbandry practices, essentially is what it is, and wildlife. And we'll also talk about welfare ranching in greater detail in a subsequent episode. You're going to hear me mention this by the end of today's episode, but we're going to talk more about welfare ranching because it's incredibly, extremely important that everyone know what it is in order to help put an end to it once and for all. And by the way, this is obviously US centric, the story I'm about to tell and the idea of welfare ranching, but it is not only in the United States. I know the same concept also happens in the UK, for instance. I haven't looked into a lot of other countries, including Australia, but I bet Australia is also affected. So this is something that I think everyone should just pay attention to and have an idea about so that they can really understand this whole picture of husbandry practices, whether it's in the water or on land. But the welfare ranching issue, of course, became top of mind for anyone following the story recently of the occupation of an Oregon National Wildlife Refuge by ranchers who were whining about the very government that subsidizes their private industry. So in short, the dispute itself started back in 1993 when cattle rancher Cliven Bundy was unhappy with the new grazing laws that still come in favor of ranchers. So in protest of these new grazing laws, he declined to renew his permit for cattle grazing on federal land. So the federal land that ranchers, that thousands and thousands of ranches and ranchers are allowed to graze their quote-unquote livestock, their cattle on, it's actually administered by the Bureau of Land Management, which is a federal government entity. And so you need to get permits, even though you get these ridiculous discounts, and I'll come back to that another time, for being able to graze your private cattle on public lands. You still have to get a permit for it. And he declined to renew his permit, but he continued to graze his cattle on these public lands without a permit. And he declared, he's kind of one of these anti-government folks, and he declared that he no longer recognized the BLM's authority to regulate his grazing, his private grazing on public land. And so fees and penalties racked up, and he kept grazing, and he was eventually charged with trespassing. His cattle were impounded, their language. And fast forward now to 2016, when in his defense, in defense of him and this anti-government kind of perspective, a number of armed protesters, mostly ranchers and those sympathetic with the ranchers, occupied this national wildlife refuge, complaining, again, national public refuge, complaining that the U.S. government doesn't have the right to claim jurisdiction over them and their lands. These are public lands, right? And yet for years, they have benefited from the government and its welfare ranching program. So welfare ranching is the term given to the federal grazing program that I mentioned that enables people like Bundy to run their livestock on public lands for cheap. It's what allows ranchers to have thousands of protected wild horses removed from public lands at public expense. So you've heard about the whole issue of the BLM, horses and donkeys, BLM, again, the Bureau of Land Management. And of course, they can have any other wild animal killed, and millions are killed by the federal government at the behest of ranchers, because if they see any wild animals in any way competing with their private stock, quote unquote, they deem them like, you know, pests and that they're infringing upon their private enterprise. About 21,000 ranches are subsidized by the federal government, mostly in the Western United States, but it's subsidized by all U.S. taxpayers. We're talking about hundreds of millions of acres of public grass and forest land, all grazed on by ranchers and paid for by the likes of you and me. National public land. So we're going to talk about this issue in greater depth, but this ties into the end of my story here, and I think it's fascinating, and there's actually some hope at the end of this story. I'm hopeful, which is amazing, because this is such a big issue, because the power of the, especially the livestock, but really the any agriculture and aquaculture industries, the power, their power is just so great in the U.S. government. So I have some hope, and stick around to hear the hope. So we're going to talk about welfare ranching in greater depth in its own episode. But the issue of the Drake's Bay Oyster Farm in the Point Reyes National Seashore just north of San Francisco is somewhat related to this. And so the U.S. Congress created Point Reyes National Seashore in 1962. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful coastline. It's just an hour north of San Francisco. You've probably visited it if you've come to the San Francisco Bay Area. Maybe you've visited the lighthouse. It's absolutely beautiful. So President Ford signed the Point Reyes Wilderness Act. So that was in 1962, it was created. President Ford in 1976 signed the Point Reyes Wilderness Act. And in the Point Reyes Wilderness area, there's an estuary called Drake's Estero. And of course, this refers to Sir Francis Drake, who came to this area about 400 years ago now. So it's called Drake's Estero. It's an estuary. And that area was designated only as potential wilderness because it contained a commercial enterprise, an oyster farm, Johnson Oyster Company. Back in 1972, that was in 76, but in 72, the federal government had bought the 5 acres of shoreline from the Johnson family for $79,200. And it provided, now this is key to understanding this story and how it plays out, it provided a 40-year lease for it to operate within the Point Reyes National Seashore, which was renewable. That lease was renewable as long as any future permit was, quote, in accordance with National Park Service regulations in effect at the time the reservation expires. So in 2005, Johnson sold that permit to the Lunny family, who renamed the oyster farm. It was Johnson Oyster Company, renamed that Drake's Bay Oyster Company. And from what I understand, from what I read, when he took over that lease in 2005, he knew full well it wasn't going to be renewed when its expiration date came. That was just clear. And so this 40-year lease agreement indeed expired in November of 2012. And the then Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced that he would close the farm. He could have extended the lease for another decade, but he ordered it shut down by the National Park Service in order to return the site to wilderness, which I have to be honest with you, I'm shocked. I'm still shocked. So if you can imagine the ranchers in the area, because I'm going to get to that in terms of that whole area is filled with cattle and dairy ranches, and the foodies of the San Francisco Bay Area threw a fit. So Michael Pollan and Alice Waters were right out in front lamenting the closure of this iconic business that sold this delicious oyster. Everyone was lamenting the closing of this delicious oyster company. And a campaign was forged with defenders pleading, save our Drake's Bay oyster farm. On the other side were environmental groups. And this is so interesting because usually that whole, you know, sustainable foodie movement and environmental groups are usually all kind of on the same page. And of course, this is wildlife we're talking about. But on the other side were the environmental groups claiming that the oyster operation disrupted harbor seal rookeries with the motorized boats. They damaged the bay's eelgrass. They ruined the water quality, and they ran a shore operation with ramshackle buildings that were an eyesore. That's a quote from the environmental groups. But on December 31st, 2014, I believe it was, after a long battle with the National Park Service, the California Coastal Commission, the Department of the Interior, and wilderness advocates, even trying to get his case heard by the Supreme Court of the United States, the Drake's Bay Oyster Farm was shut down. And the National Park Service, it's shut down. Like, it's shut down. Like, they've removed the buildings. They removed all of the trestles and all of the, where all of the oysters were. I mean, these were young oysters that were being kept to grow, to be sizable enough to be killed and then sold. So the National Park Service intends to turn this 2,700-acre area into the first federally designated marine wilderness area on the West Coast, giving this estuary special protected status as an unaltered ecological region. It's amazing. The estuary is home to like tens of thousands of endangered birds, including 90 species, and the largest seal colony on the coast. Now, you can read all about this fascinating battle. I really recommend this book. It's called The Oyster War: The True Story of a Small Farm, Big Politics, and the Future of Wilderness in America. It's by Summer Brennan, and I will put the link to it on my website, again, on the show notes for today's episode. Summer Brennan was a journalist who was there for the whole battle. She was there the entire time. And really, this story is about agriculture, in this case, aquaculture, versus the wild, versus the wilderness. It's about private interests, however popular they are, against the public interest and against the wilderness, against the wild animals, against just these ecosystems. Where does our hands like getting into everything end, and the wilderness begin, where they get to have their own space untouched by human intervention. That's what these stories are about. Sometimes they're mutually exclusive. From what I see, the wild tends to lose when private interests are at stake, especially private interests as powerful and entrenched in the federal government as the aqua and agriculture industries are. It's one of the reasons I am actually shocked that Salazar stuck to his guns and closed the place down in the interest of the wild. I'm a little suspect. Like, I'm still like suspicious. Like, really? But now this is where the welfare ranch ties in. Interestingly, Salazar, who is a strong supporter of sustainable agriculture, and he is no vegetarian, is dedicated to keeping Point Reyes ranching and farming heritage alive. So even though he closed down this oyster farm, which, as I said, has impacts on the environment, there are environmental impacts, negative ones, he is dedicated to keeping the ranches alive. So he directed Park Service officials to pursue extensions of agriculture permits from 10 to 20 years within the seashore's pastoral zone. So in other words, the 20 or so dairy farms and cattle ranches and sheep herders who lease this land for very little money will have their leases extended pretty much automatically, which is pretty much how it tends to work. So for 10 to 20 more years. Now, I wonder if it's an attempt to appease the ranchers of the area who sided with Drake's Bay Oyster Company and who no doubt were afraid this was going to happen to them, that they were going to be also closed down, right? You know, they were probably afraid of what was going to happen to them because Drake's Bay had closed down. So I don't know. That's only a question I'm raising. I suspect there's some of that appeasement going on, but it's also just par for the course. I mean, the people who benefit from this welfare ranching program that the federal government has been allowing for decades are used to pretty much getting their way. It's why Bundy was so upset when there were any changes. I mean, you can't even change the amount per unit, per animal unit that they are asked to pay. I mean, I'm going to talk more about this in another episode. It is remarkable how this whole system works. So that's a possibility. But it's worth saying that in terms of environmental and ethical impacts, I would probably rather see an oyster farm stay and dairy and cattle ranches close, but that wasn't the, you know, unfortunately, that wasn't the choice. That wasn't even the scenario, or at least to see the cattle ranches have to pay like the actual market rate of what it would cost to actually graze their animals on private land. Of course, they get just these cheap grazing rights on public land. So, you know, that wasn't the scenario, but in terms of environmental and ethical impacts, you can compare and say the dairy farms and the cattle ranches, of course, have great impact. So I'm not the only one to be concerned about this, and this is where I find my hope. This month, February 2016, three environmental groups, and I'll write these names down, I'll put them on the website as well. Resource Renewal Institute, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Western Watersheds Project, this is amazing, have filed suit against the National Park Service, yes, the same National Park Service that closed down the oyster farm, alleging that it's violating the law by renewing ranching leases without first looking out for the park's preservation. It calls for the Park Service to stop renewing ranch leases and void recent extensions, at least until the impacts of beef and dairy businesses are addressed. They allege that the dairy and beef operations in the federal Point Reyes National Seashore receive priority treatment at the expense of this national wild treasure. I don't think it's a coincidence at all that less than a year after, or about a year after the Drake's Bay Oyster Farm was forced to shut down, that this coalition of environmental groups is going after a much bigger and much more powerful target, the ranchers. In the suit filed in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco against the National Park Service by these groups, they claim that the cattle are causing erosion, polluting waterways with manure, harming endangered salmon and other species, and blocking public access. I mean, it's remarkable. The groups say that Park Service officials are violating federal law because they're moving forward with a plan to renew 20-year leases to the ranchers without conducting adequate environmental studies on how the thousands of cows are affecting the seashore's scenic resources, including its tule elk. Nor have officials updated their 36-year-old park management plan to consider other options, like reducing the number of ranches in the park or the size of the cattle herds, so the lawsuit contends. But here's the best part of the story. If the lawsuit is successful, this coalition plans to try and reduce or remove livestock from some of the roughly 30 other national parks that allow grazing, a list that includes Death Valley, Pinnacles in San Benito County, and Mojave National Preserve. If I were you, I would contact these organizations and find out what the public can do to get involved. To put an end to welfare ranching would be unprecedented. I mean, the effects of getting cattle and these private industries off of wild public land, the effects would be beyond what our wildest dreams could imagine for wildlife. And so that's what this comes down to for me. The oysters, the bivalves, aquaculture, agriculture. When we can do better, we should. When we can create less harm, we should. When we can choose the wild over the cultivated, I believe we should. There are impacts to farming and harvesting and consuming oysters. There are impacts on everything we do. You've heard me say the question is not, can we make a difference? The fact is we do make a difference. Everything we do, everything we buy, everything we eat has an impact on someone or something else. We don't get to decide whether we can make a difference or not. We get to decide only if the difference we inevitably make is negative or positive. Those are our only two choices. Those are the questions we need to ask. And when there is gray, I think we should apply the precautionary principle. Do bivalves have a heart? No. Do they have a brain? No. And I don't care. But I have a heart. And I have a brain, and those two organs give me the ability to make the most compassionate choices. Or when I can't do that because it's actually impossible, not because it's inconvenient or not in my personal interest, at least I can make the least harmful choice. If we can't use the hearts and minds we have as humans to make the most compassionate choices, then really, what's the difference between us and oysters? What's the difference between us and bivalves? I guess you could eat us and justify eating us because we don't have hearts and minds, but we do. We have hearts and minds, and my hope is that we can use our hearts and minds to make the most compassionate, to make the kindest, least harmful choices. For The Animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.